My name's Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.
Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to this very special episode of the Empire Podcast, dedicated to the living legend that is Kurt Russell. He's played all kinds of iconic figures in his illustrious five-decade career. There's Elvis. There's Snake Plissken. RJ McCready from The Thing. Cash from Tango and Cash. Or is it Tango from Tango and Cash? I can never quite remember. There's Stuntman Mike. There's Jack Burton. To name but... Six. And now we can add Santa Claus to the list. Russell stars as Santa in The Christmas Chronicles, which is out now on Netflix and is a lovely slab of feel-good, slightly cheesy Christmas fun. But we all know there's one reason why we're watching it, because Kurt Russell is playing Santa with his Elvis swagger intact. I've long had Russell on my Christmas list for the show, and when he came to London recently, someone checked a list. They checked it twice. They found out if I was naughty or nice, and they gave me the green light to have an audience with the great man. And so here it is, a lovely 30 minutes or so in which Russell explains why he felt he had to play Santa, his connection to the role, what Christmas is like round the Russell Goldie Hawn household, and how he unleashed his inner Elvis in one particular scene. Then we broaden things out to talk about how his approach to acting has changed in the 57 years he's been in the game, and talk about his great collaboration with John Carpenter on Escape from New York and The Thing. Usually I start these interviews with a big introduction of the guest to the guest's face, but as Kurt, my old friend Kurt, were already chatting away when I pressed record, this one starts in media res with a bit of John Carpenter chat. So don't let that throw you too much. In fact, let me try and make this more like a normal pod by saying, delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the star of The Christmas Chronicles, the legendary Kurt Russell. How are you, sir? And now we can go. Please do enjoy.
I tell you what, you should listen to the new, they've revamped the Escape from New York
theme. Oh, really?
Oh, there's a bit where the drums kick in. Oh, it's amazing.
It's good, huh?
It's amazing. It's great. Good stuff. I could lose my shit talking about this all day. But
he's just such a creative guy, and he has such a distinctive look on the world, you know?
Yeah.
And it translates to his filmmaking and music and... Well, he's a talented guy.
He's a very, you know, he's obviously a very laid back and laconic guy as well. And, you know, was he always like that whenever you guys were, you first hooked up on Elvis?
Yeah. He's got a lot of, it's really interesting. He's got a lot of energy, but he's very, what's the word? He's where he's from. I guess he's from, is it Bowling Green?
Yeah.
You know, but his knowledge and his education are, pretty steep.
Yeah.
And he just had this ability to put it into his work.
Yeah.
Yeah. He could create. He can create stories and he can create visions and sounds. And I every once in a while when we were working together, well, it didn't make any difference what it was. I just every once in a while I'd notice the camera and the angle that it was at and the view that it was projecting, and so I'd go behind the camera and look at it, you know, I mean, when the stand-ins were in there.
Yeah.
if, and it was, you know, I just say, that's just different. It's just his view of what it is. And he was just, but he's just such, I just really, yeah, I love the guy. He's a great person.
He's amazing. We'll get on to your work with him in detail, I'm sure, soon. But I want to talk about this film first, The Christmas Chronicles, because, you know, you started off, well, you didn't start off. Obviously, you started off kicking Elvis a few years ago in your career. But you played Elvis years ago, and you must have thought, that's it. That's as iconic as it can possibly get. And then along comes Santa Claus, which must have been fairly unexpected.
That's very much the way I looked at it. It was, certainly the most iconic character I'll ever play is probably Santa Claus, because I'm not going to play Jesus Christ. I'm not going to do Muhammad. I'm not going to do Buddha. I mean, who's been around for 1,700 years?
Give Elvis time.
Yeah, give Elvis time. You know, will Elvis make 1,700 years? I don't, you know, they won't even, you know, there's no way to look at any person who was a real person, who was born, lived, created, a legend, created a mythical stance, and the lore that surrounds Santa Claus is literally 1,700 years old. I thought, wow, what an opportunity. I was fascinated by my own interest in learning about St. Nicholas, which I kind of continue to want to do. And to put it in the light of a Chris Columbus Harry Potter / Home Alone feeling I thought just right. I was really excited about meeting with Clay Cadis and Chris when I read it, because our family is really steeped in Christmas history. Santa Claus is a big deal in our family, and you know, ever since we were kids, Goldie and I have continued that in our family, and it continues on through our children. And so I looked at this as wait a minute, let's really talk about this for a second, and let's talk about where is this guy at? Where's he coming from? Where's he at? Mm. And I don't want to blow this opportunity. I don't want to miss this. You know?
Well, it must be an intriguing prospect for an actor as well. Very few people have played Santa Claus.
Yeah.
So to put you get a real chance to go, okay, this is mine. I'm making it my own.
It's fair to say that I look at it as wanting to do a definitive version.
Yeah.
And anytime I've played anybody who was real, a person who existed, I did always feel the obligation to try to capture at least the essence of who that person really was.
Yes.
And certainly, if you're going to do Elvis, especially at the timing of it, it was only a year and a half after he died. That project was already underway when Elvis was still alive. And I've done, you know, Herb Brooks. I met him. Unfortunately, tragically died before he was never able to see the finished product.
Yeah.
But a heavy obligation to capture the essence of Herb. And I felt that way about Santa Claus, not a comic book character, not a character that you're inventing or creating. This is an iconic individual who I felt an obligation to learn something about and say, well, okay, in the light and tone of what Christmas is and what he means to Christmas, what would be the right thing to bring to this character? And one of the things was he has an intimidating presence. I mean, whenever I was dressed up and in my full regalia ready to go, and children might pass by, or they did exactly what I felt when I was their age and remember, which was I was fascinated by Santa Claus. Anybody who looked like that, I wanted to look at. But if it was... Even if it was a mall Santa, it's like when you got close, your eyes started diverting down.
Yeah.
You couldn't look at him. You couldn't really. He was a presence. There was an intimidation factor there that I didn't want to not have. I thought that was important in this. And right off the bat, that's what you kind of get this guy who he knows who he is. He loves who he is. He loves what he does and what he gets to do. But we do find out through the process of watching these two kids deal with him in this situation they're in, learn about, you know, who this guy is really. I mean, they spend the night with that guy.
And it's a sort of role. I mean, I can just imagine you just having so much fun. You look like you're having a lot of fun.
I did. And I thought it was important to look right. You know, it was important to have the image right. And then I started thinking about the sound and I thought, wait a minute. He speaks every language. This was the stuff that we actually brought to the existing screenplay. There was no Elvish dialogue.
Oh, really? Okay.
I said, wait a minute. They live in their own world. They would speak their own. They've got their own language. Yeah. He would certainly speak it.
Yeah.
But you know, when he's dropping off presents in China, he's speaking Chinese. When he's in, you know, when he's in Thailand, he's speaking Thai. When he's in Mexico, he's speaking Spanish. And when he's in France, he's speaking French.
And when he's over in America?
When he's in America, he's speaking slang American, too. You know, he knows all these things. Thank you. He knows all these things. Yeah, he knows. Yeah. I mean, if he knows when you're awake and he knows when you're asleep, if he knows when you're being good or when you're being bad, he not only knows every street in the world, he knows everything. And it was important to kind of start looking at it from that point of view. Start looking at it really from the point of view. I always looked at it from the point of view of the two kids, but mainly Teddy, who's like 14, 15.
In
a difficult time in his life, relationship with his father, which was, by the way, played by Oliver Hudson, who's my son, my stepson. So it was exciting for me to have him do that. But to look at it from his point of view, here's a guy who's lost. Not only is he in this difficult period in his life, dealing with his father and the issues that brings about. Won't go into it in detail, so I don't wreck it. But at that time in your life, to be confronted with the reality of something you've completely tossed away, that Santa Claus is a real person.
Yeah.
I always thought that was key. Like if that happened to me, my whole belief system and what I think I know would be shot out the window.
Yeah, of course.
So, and in a wonderful way. So.
No, it's lovely, heartwarming stuff. And you get this lovely moment as well. You get to rock out. I think we can give that away.
Yeah. No, I matter of fact, that came about because Chris and I were, I felt that, and we talked about that in our initial meeting, that there was a point in the movie where he was, you know, Santa's in jail. Mm-hmm. And, he wasn't really doing anything. And I said, that's not really right. He can't be just, we can't, even though I have this idea, which I had to go into about why he's letting certain things happen.
Yeah.
And why he's steering things a certain way, unbeknownst to us.
Yeah.
He must be active and doing something. And both Chris and I had the same feeling, which was, there's music here somewhere. This is where there should be music, and he should be a part of it. And it should be a fun scene that is sort of a classic thing. And we talked about all the different angles we could have fun with it, and we started coming down to it. And we had three, four ideas that we were tossing around. Chris found this great song that was so apropos. The lyrics were apropos. The whole thing was apropos to Santa's situation. Mm-hmm. That Elvis had done a recording of, and yeah, because I had played Elvis, and there was some connecting of the dots that could be kind of a fun.
Yeah,
it was the right thing to do. It's a great idea to have an idea, and then you've kind of look out, you just might get what you wish for. Now you got to do it, and thank God for me for Stevie Van Zandt, because he. He just came through and flying colors. He did that. He put the music together and made me feel very, very comfortable and confident to have some fun.
Yeah.
And it was in the context that it was done, in the playfulness with Elvis, it was something that I could feel confident with. And
absolutely.
It is fun. It is a really fun scene. And he does get Christmas spirit going.
It really does. Is there an alternative universe where, Kurt Russell is a music megastar with 10 platinum number one albums hanging on the wall of the homestead?
That would be nice to believe. That's a fun thought.
You've never been tempted to
Well, if it's taking place, it's taking place in an altered universe. Not
have
in
you
mine.
No idea what's happening?
Yeah, exactly. I might be surprised, but happily so. Okay. Yeah, I like everybody else. That has to be for everyone a daydream, at least, you know, to be on stage and to be able to perform, you know, to be able to make music, to be able to sing, to be able to create that. Yeah, I can't say that I don't have that daydream. That would be very fun.
Well, technically speaking, this song could be released for the I'm just saying, you know, Christmas number one over here is a big thing, Kurt. It's a big thing.
It's big in our house.
I can see you coming back, you performing know. On the Top of the Pops or whatever
don't,
it is.
Don't hold your breath.
Fair enough. You mentioned there that Christmas has been a big thing for you all through the years. And in what way? What's a typical Christmas like down at the Russell
Well, what
household?
We do, and we're getting ready, you know, at this time of the year, as soon as you get past like Halloween, it's kind of like you're starting to get close because there's a tremendous pressure on getting great presents, you know.
I can imagine there is.
I mean, there really is. I mean, we start thinking about, you know, who needs what, who wants what, and then hints start flying around behind people's backs and a lot of conversations. You're headed for a lot of fun. What we do is we go to Colorado. We've had a ranch there for a long time. And Goldie and I usually get there a little bit early. The place is all decorated. It's fantastic. It's a fantastic setting, I gotta say. It's just in the Rockies, and it's beautiful. Mm. And then all the kids come, all the grandkids will be there, all some friends come. Like I said, there's a lot of clandestine conversations about, you know, what have you heard? And then, you know, on Christmas Eve, we trim the tree. Uh-huh. And that you know, that's where it starts, is picking the great tree. And we've got a, you know, great living room window that looks out over the mountains, the perfect place to put the tree. It's all good. And the house, like I said, it's just all decorated to the nines and very, very, very festive. And on Christmas Eve, you know, we have a big Christmas Eve dinner. And then the kids all jump into their kind of specialty Christmas pajamas. And with the fire's going in the fireplace, then we hang the stockings, and then we it was getting dark, and we sit down, and our tradition is to we always pick someone that year to read "Twas the Night Before Christmas."
Oh my God!
And generally, you know, shortly thereafter, within a 5-10 minute period, don't be surprised if you hear sleigh bells. And if you do, you just might look out the window and maybe out there in the snow catch a glimpse of what looked like maybe there he is. Oh my God! One year he actually peeked his head in our front door, and everybody turned around. We you know, the kids saw him and they completely panicked. And because you're supposed to be asleep, if you're not asleep, when Santa comes by. You know, you may get nothing. He may, you know, you may wake up and there's coal there. Or he, you know, he may just pass on past your house.
Yeah.
You know, so it's panic time, complete pandemonium. They run upstairs, jump in bed real quick. And then, of course, the next morning is to me one of the maybe the best morning of the year when the lights are out and there's just a couple on that are a nice soft glow in the living room and outside that's just beginning to maybe come daylight. Mm. And, the snow is on the ground, and there's this beautiful sight of the stockings stuffed and Santa presents underneath that, and mixed with lots of presents coming out from under the tree, and it's generally a full day of you know, it's the one day of the year that we do that. Christmas is really a big thing, whereas birthdays we observe, but it might be a one present from one person you know, so it's not a big huge deal. Whereas this is. You know, let's face it, we got a big family and everybody's getting everybody's, you know, at least one or two things.
So the present giving alone takes 3 hours.
No, 3 hours is, wouldn't that be nice? No, it's, it goes well into the late afternoon.
Oh my God.
So it's a big deal in our house,
And then this year you're going to be watching the Christmas Chronicles, get everyone around.
Well, we're going to do that on the 18th in Los Angeles. There is a premiere, and for the first time ever, and I mean, I'm talking about 57 years of being in this business. For the first time ever, I'm letting everybody know that they want to come to this one, because there's actually a lot of references Okay. That only my family will fully appreciate.
Okay.
even the guys, I mean, there's going to be some hoots and hollers that even Chris and Clay and Monica and the kids, Judah and Darby, what was that? Why were they, who's screaming over there? What? There's some things that nobody knows about it except for those family members. So I can't wait for them to see it.
That's incredible. So you've been doing this 57 years, as you said. Over the years, has your style and has your approach to acting changed? It must have changed over those decades.
Yeah, I've gone through different periods of like being interested in different, slightly different approaches. I mean, I think I've always concentrated on trying to be the character, just behave the character as it best serves the story.
Mm-hmm.
But be as entertaining as you can, be as creative as you can. But then specifically, every once in a while I'd go through different things. Like I remember when I was doing the Travels of Jamie McFeeters, I was 12 years old and I'd seen 3 or 4 shows and I really didn't like what I was doing. And the reason I didn't like it was because it was going against my instinct.
Mm-hmm.
Now that was just me trying to find comfort in learning how to, take direction.
Mm-hmm.
And then translate it well. I could take the direction, but I couldn't. To the naked eye, that being not my eye, it looked at least good enough for them to say print and move on. But I could see this tightness and uncomfortableness within myself. And I just remember literally going to work one day and saying, I'm not doing that anymore. And so whenever directors especially, now, I'm playing a character that we did 26 shows of, and the writing is what the writing is. I knew who the character of Jamie McFeeters was. This is it was a Western.
Yeah.
And I'd started in the process of doing it my way, as it were. But that wasn't fully realized until I did Elvis. And I said, and I told John, because I'd been cast already, and John came on as the director. He was already saddled with an actor. You know, it really was interesting.
Yeah.
That's very rare. And he was game. And he saw the tape that I'd done for the people. I told him, I said, John, you know, this is just one of those things. I just got to do this. I have to just do this my way. We have to learn to speak in shorthand.
Yeah.
You know, to where you say a little more, a little less, and that's about it, you know, for me. And he said, I totally understand, and I get it, you're right. And we got there very quickly. I just really I instantly trusted him. It was very unique. And and after that, which was the first time I just completely just did it my way.
Okay.
I said, that's okay. From now on, I'll talk, I'll listen, I'll try, and it's my job to try to bring the director's vision to the screen. I get that. But within that, I have to be comfortable. Mm-hmm. And if I can't get comfortable, then there's going to be a problem. Because if I can't get past that to do what you need to have done, I've got to find a way that I'm comfortable with that qualifies for what it is you're looking for.
Okay.
And then there was that long period of time. And then then there's times where I'd say, I don't really want to know I don't want to know this thing so well that I don't have to search within the process of doing it. I want to have the character search for what he's trying to say or what he's trying to get across. Mm. And so there was a time where I didn't really want to know my lines that well. I wanted to know them, but I wanted them to sort of come to me rather than just having them there.
When was that period, roughly?
I guess that was about 20 years ago.
Okay.
And then I learned from that what I wanted to learn. And, you know, as you get older, you just finally get to it. I finally got to a place where I just, I'm going to just take this part. I understand what it is. And then I'm going to work with the actors and work with the director. We'll just sit basically and listen and do. And you don't think anymore. You don't think.
Yeah.
You're just doing it. And, when you get there, then you're not watching yourself. That's a big thing. When you I never really did a lot of that, but when I'm guilty of it, yeah. I freeze. I just say,
"Oh, really?"
I just okay. Hey, whoops, room full of mirrors here, guys. I'm doing nothing but watching myself here. Really, really, what not to, where not to be.
No. Does your approach change with the director, for example? Are you a different?
Absolutely.
Are you a different actor on a Tarantino set?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. In what way?
Absolutely. Oh, it depends on him or her. Yeah. They're the captain of the ship. It is their show. It's their movie. It's their vision. I've been on quite a few that that didn't really exist. There wasn't really a vision. When that gets bad enough, then because of the amount of experience I've had and with the people that I've had them with in terms of learning, you have to step in. That's just what has to happen because the project needs that. And it's really not that difficult a thing to do if you're in the right position and if you're starring in the show. And the reason we're doing this is because you said yes, then you are in that position. I think that has to remain quiet. It's not a good thing, you know. And you have to do it. You have to do it stylishly and correctly. It's. I don't. Those are rough moments. They're rough experiences. But when a director really does have a vision and you're in cahoots with it, generally, what I find is you can just be as creative as you want to be because you're all headed down the same train track. You're all going in the same direction. And generally those experiences are extremely positive and the result is generally really, really good.
I mean, I'm drawn back towards Escape from New York in a way because working with John again, there must have been a moment, I guess, on Elvis where the two of you thought, hang on, this isn't just working. This is really working. We want to do this again.
Yeah, there was. I'm sure that there were people that I had worked with or that John had worked with that he had, really good feelings about or that I had really good feelings about. But I never had worked with somebody first of all, I'd never done it my way. I'd never completely just said, I'm doing this. And there was a freedom there, I think, that both of us found with each other. I never even had one thought about John as a director. Like, is that right? Or is that, is that what we're supposed to be? Is that what we're supposed to be doing here? Is that helping things? Or I never had one thought. It was just I was just going to do what John wanted to do. And I mean, John, in terms of directing, I maybe four times in our life that he might have come up to me and talked to me for 10 seconds, because we saw it the same. He gave me this great freedom to create the character. Snake Plissken was just what was on paper appealed to me as an actor to try to bring to life what I thought it said. And when I suggested, he'd asked me, what do you think he should look like? What do you think he should wear? He was asking me these things. And it was like, and I had answers very much like this, I think, that's that. And then when I went to him and said, I also think you should have an eye patch. And he laughed and he said, oh. Okay. He said, nobody's worn an eye patch since John Wayne in True Grit. And I said, okay. I don't know anything about that. He said, great. I said, it's like some, but I said, he said, I don't want to get into why, but why? And I said, I think there's something wrong with his eye. Something happened, like radiation or something got in there during the war. And it's a constant pain that he's gotten used to, but it's there. And, or maybe we find out that, he has an electronic eye under there or something. Who knows what? And he laughed and he said, oh, I like the way that looks. And he was great with it. And then the only thing left for me on the Snake was what he sounded like. And when he cast, because I didn't know where I was going to go with that. Mm. And when he cast Lee Van Cleef, I said, oh, I see what we're doing. I got it. I know what to do.
Yeah.
I know exactly now. And then we did the first scene, and I'll never forget this because it really was, talk about a director making an actor feel confident. We didn't rehearse anything. We didn't do anything. We shoot the first scene, which was a scene that was eventually cut out of the movie. It was the very beginning of the movie. It was a train sequence where he robbed a national.
It's a bank, wasn't it?
It was a bank. It was credit cards. It was only credit cards.
Yeah, yeah.
And he has one line to the guy. He says, "Congratulations, you're a millionaire." To the character that he's robbing the bank with. And I did that. I remember. It's the first time I'm going to say anything. Was, "Congratulations, you're a millionaire." and I got looking cut, and John comes over and he goes, this fucking character is going to be great. And I just was like, oh, good, you know, because I didn't know. Maybe John coming up, okay, what are we doing here? You know, it was always just that way with John. I just, he made me feel always comfortable, excited about doing everything that we were going to be doing. And just, hey, we're just a couple of kids having fun. I mean, that's sort of the way it was.
That's amazing. And actually, that's kind of was what I was going to ask about, where that confidence comes from, that you can do something like a Clint Eastwood impression.
He got,
you know,
yeah, he got or, the, well, first of all, with John, there was, I didn't have to explain the fun of it, the inside of it. You know, at that time, Clint Eastwood was not quite the icon that he became, you know. Yeah. It was just my, it was like, oh, this is going to work with Lee Van Cleef in a really interesting way. But I had a whole movie to do without Lee Van Cleef, you know, so it made, they had to make sense for, it had to make sense for Snake. The tattoo, we'd done some pre-movie promotion for probably get money for the movie. And I said, I think on the arm is just kind of too conventional. He said, what do you think? And I said, I think it should be a big cobra right down his stomach and going down his pants. And he went, yeah, that's good. But what was always inspiring for me with John, whatever it was, whether it's The Thing or Big Trouble in Little China, whatever, it's his set. It was his set. The same is true for Tarantino. There are these guys who inspire you just by the way you feel on the set. They so know what they're doing. They so know what they want that the day is just to be enjoyed. They both have great crews. I mean, really top-notch, great people who love doing what they do. I just think that they both have a way of putting unique casts together that are all there for the right reasons. Mm. And when you see their movies, you kind of get that feeling. There's some oddball choices that work fabulously. They just know, you know, what they're doing.
That's what
gives you confidence. So rare, it's like, well, hey, if they know what they're doing, I'm gonna roll with this here, and you know, let's feel good.
Obviously, at the moment, Jamie Lee Curtis is making a big splash, returning to a role that she made famous in a John Carpenter movie 40 years ago, which made me think that maybe you could do that with, there's Snake. Jack Burton is still on the table.
You know what?
There's a Big Trouble Little China sequel in the works.
Yeah, the thing is that we did do one sequel for Escape. It's the only one I've ever done. There was a three-part. There was a thing I did early on with Disney where there were three movies that all took place at Medfield College, and the character was Dexter Riley. But there was no character there. He was just a guy. He was just a, you know, he was a college student. Yeah. So now with me, I prefer to go from Snake to R.J. McCready to Jack Burton and create these people, to go to the Hangman, to go to, you know, Stuntman Mike, to go to Rudy Russo and use cars. I wanted to go to different people so that I could end up maybe someday going to Santa Claus. Because if you keep doing Snake, you don't get to do Santa Claus. If you keep doing Rudy Russo, you don't get to do Snake. Yeah. You know, I that was where I felt my bread was buttered, because it would keep my interest going and my fascination with what this business has to offer. And it was to challenge myself to the fun of creating as many characters as I could.
Well, I wish you all the best in the future. And I wish you all the best for your Christmas as well.
Thank you.
And I think I know what we could get you as a Christmas present. The Thing board game. Have you heard of this thing?
No, I haven't.
It's
heard
amazing.
Of that.
There's a whole board game. Yeah, I haven't played it yet, but it looks incredible. You're a board game
that's
guy,
cool.
Kurt.
I am. I kind of do like that stuff. It's been fun over the years to see some of these pictures that we did have a whole life that takes off. You know, off because we liked them when we were doing them. You know, we did. We thought they were just a blast to do, and so it's fun to see that happening with whatever it is. I think it's fun to watch that happen.
Oh, fantastic! Well, maybe we can make that work out for you. And get one sent out to you. In the meantime, I have to say this to you. Let's just sit here for a little while, see what happens.
That's very interesting because we talked about that for 3 weeks.
That scene.
Where do we go with that scene? Because John said, I don't want to take him on a 2-hour ride and come right back to where we started. And after we'd go, we tried many different versions. And the last one was like, he said, what do you got? We could do that every day. What do you got? And we'd break it down and go, that's not. Then I said, I think this is I think where we're at here is this, is that this is what this story is. There's no way to know. And so why don't we just, I think I have a flamethrower on him. He has a gun on me, or the other way around. I have a gun. One of us has got a gun. One of us got a flamethrower. We both got a way to kill each other.
One's got a bottle of whiskey. That's for sure.
and the camp and it's going to be cold here soon, and that thing's going to freeze. And if it freezes, it's won. So that's not going to happen, but, what are we going to do? Well, and that was what that's all I had to say was, let's just wait and see what happens.
It's amazing. Knowing the shit that John went through to get that ending in, actually on screen is incredible.
Yeah. That's primarily basically living on that set.
Yeah.
I think it was 28, 29 degrees inside.
God.
And we were up there for so long that felt like 50. we'd come in and take all our coats off and everything for about 45 minutes to warm up. Yeah, those are great memories. It was a great time. Yeah, John Carpenter. Wow, there was a book they wanted me to write something for. It was a Big Trouble in Little China, and I remember thinking, I want to write the right thing, and I tried to, and I said when it comes to Big Trouble in Little China, for instance, but this was true for all things that John did. I as Jack Burton would say, I got three words for you: John Carpenter, John Carpenter, John Carpenter. Those were his worlds. You know, he created those worlds. They were his worlds. We were all of us fortunate enough to play in it.
Oh man, Kurt Russell, I could talk to you all day, but I will let you go. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
It's good talking to you.
Cheers.
And that was a great Kurt Russell, and I didn't even ask about Tango and Cash or Backdraft, so we'll have to get him back in one day, maybe. For Christmas Chronicles 2. And that is it from this very special edition of the Empire Podcast. The regular pod is up every Friday. If you don't already subscribe, please do so. And please say nice things about us on iTunes, which always helps. Look out for more specials coming your way as well over the coming days and weeks. Until we meet again, I've been Chris Hewitt. Thanks so much for listening. Bye.